in a way, that DVD is the easiest way into the whole argument. You should start really with the DVD, then go on to the Narnia code book, and then when you want all the detail possible, then go to Planet Narnia.
I'm William O'Flaherty. Welcome to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. As you might be aware, at the time I'm releasing this show, it's the 65th anniversary of the release of the first Narnia story. That's right, in October 1950, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe debuted. Because of this, I thought it would be a good time to re-release my first conversation with Dr. Michael Ward I had back in 2012. It was about his book, The Narnia Code. My chat with him briefly explores that book and the DVD by that name, as well as some aspects of the more scholarly offering called Planet Narnia. This was done before I did a 13-part series exploring each chapter from The Narnia Code. Also, because of this special anniversary, I'm also re-releasing a series of shows I did that explored each of the Narnia books themselves. In fact, only the first show was ever shared on All About Jack. This 7-part series will start weekly on Friday, October the 16th, because that's the date The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe first came out. But back to this show. My conversation with Dr. Ward began with him answering the question how he became interested in C.S. Lewis.
Became interested in Lewis the same way most people do, I suspect, in that I had the Narnia books read to me when I was a child by my parents and loved them, read them for myself when I was a bit older, and then his other fiction and his Christian apologetics when I was in my teenage years. Then I did an English degree at Oxford, and so I began studying Lewis's academic works at that point and did a short undergraduate thesis on him at Oxford. Graduated, began to do bits of tutoring and lecturing on him, and then I eventually ended up doing my PhD on him as well. So from those small beginnings of having the Chronicles read to me as a kid, it's turned into a kind of pretty much full-time career teaching, lecturing, writing all about Lewis.
Regarding your two books, they deal with the same subject, again, Planet Narnia and the Narnia Code. They're obviously then similar, but briefly tell us why there happen to be two and who is the target audience for each.
Planet Narnia came first. That is basically my PhD thesis turned into a book. That's detailed, lengthy, quite complex, and some would say heavy going. Other people say that it's meaty and pure protein, but a lot of people didn't want that level of detail, and so I wrote a much shorter, more accessible, more popular version called The Narnia Code, and that was published by Paternoster and Tyndale a couple of years after Planet Narnia. Planet Narnia was published by Oxford University Press in 2008, and it then in hardback, and then it was released in paperback in 2010.
Then how long before the Narnia Code came out?
Narnia Code also came out in 2010, and the Narnia Code is also the name of a BBC documentary that was broadcast in 2009, actually. The BBC got interested in Planet Narnia, and they commissioned this hour-long documentary called The Narnia Code, and that was really what led to the shorter book, the Narnia Code book.
You gave us some background about how you came to write these books, so would you mind giving us more of the story? I remember seeing the video actually talking about that. Could you share some portions of that?
Yes, the basic argument of both books is that the Narnia Chronicles have a symbolic coherence, a unifying symbolic logic to them, which Lewis deliberately used in order to construct the stories, but kept to himself. And that symbolic logic is the seven heavens, the seven planets of the pre-Copernican cosmos, which Lewis, being a medieval literary historian, knew all about and wrote about extensively in his academic works, but also in his earlier fiction. The Ransom Trilogy, for instance, uses that symbolic system very explicitly, as does a great deal of his poetry. And I was reading Lewis's long poem called The Planets. I was halfway through my PhD research, and as I read that planet's poem, I noticed that when Lewis was writing about the planet Jupiter, the best planet, as it was understood by the medievals, He said that one of the things Jupiter was believed to bring about was the passing of winter and the forgiving of guilt. And that caused a little light bulb to go on in my head and made me think of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, because, of course, that story is all about the passing of winter and the forgiving of Edmund's guilt. So I began to look a bit more closely at this long, detailed poem about the planets, and it seemed as though a great deal of the imagery in the poem linked up with imagery in the Chronicles. And the more I looked, the more it seemed that this was indeed the imaginative scheme, the imaginative blueprint, as it were, that controlled Lewis's constructing of the Narnia books, which in any case had been a question that had occupied me and a good deal of other Lewis scholars and critics for many years, because it's not very obvious why the Chronicles are as they are. Three of the books are very clearly biblical reimaginings, as it were. You've got a gospel story in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, you've got a creation story in The Magician's Nephew, and you've got a Last Judgment story in The Last Battle. But the other four Chronicles are so clearly linked to biblical events and episodes. And so a lot of scholars and critics have asked why this unevenness, why this lack of apparent uniformity across the series. And all sorts of different theories have been suggested, like the seven deadly sins and the seven sacraments. But no one had ever seriously considered the seven heavens. And yet that is all over Lewis's work. And that indeed, I believe, is the undergirding symbolic logic to those seven Chronicles.
I guess a common objection I'm sure you've heard, and I've also thought through, I haven't quite heard, maybe you have addressed it, an answer, but I've thought of probably what you might say, and that is, well, Lewis didn't like plan out the Narnia books. He like was just going to write one, and then the other came, and things like that. Now, that's probably an unfair summary, but for those who say, well, Lewis, you know, in some ways didn't like say, okay, let me get an overall structure and then I can do seven stories. What would you say to those who might be thinking that?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite right that when he began writing The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, he only had one book in mind. But my argument isn't that he set out with the intention of writing seven stories, each one for a planet. My belief is that he set out with the intention of writing just one story, but themed to the symbolism of Jupiter, because Jupiter was his favourite planet, the planet which he jokingly used to say that he himself had been born under, and the planet which he also said needed to be imaginatively rehabilitated in the 20th century. In one of his early essays, he says, "Who does not need to be reminded of Jove, that is, Jupiter?" He thought that too much of his own contemporary culture in the 1920s and 30s was fixated on the qualities not of Jupiter, but Saturn. Saturn was the planet of death and disaster and loss and pestilence and all bad things. And Lewis used to say that the 1930s culture was Saturnocentric, fixated upon these Saturnine qualities, which was all very understandable given the calamity of the Great War, which everyone had just been through. But Lewis also thought that that was a kind of historical accident. It wasn't an eternal truth about the nature of the universe. And a much better way of symbolizing the heart of spiritual reality was through the symbolism of Jupiter, the kingly planet, the festive, tranquil, magnanimous, joyful. So when he came to write The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, I believe he wanted to use those symbolic qualities in writing that first chronicle without any intention of doing any more than just that first one. But after he'd done one, he evidently thought that he'd do another, and then another, and then eventually all seven.
For those who maybe aren't still convinced, a way of summarizing could be the following. Just like, because Lewis was a very rooted Christian, he naturally, his stories, biblical elements come through for those who are aware of noticing them. Likewise, because of his background in what he taught, and he was very well read and understood medieval and Renaissance literature, that those symbolism naturally would bubble up. And so while he didn't like one day say, okay, I'm going to write seven books and there's going to be all based on the planets, that naturally came through because he was so well versed and well read in that realm. And those who just casually read Narnia, are probably unaware that, oh, well, he didn't just write children's books, although they're not really just children's books. He wasn't just a Christian apologetic person. He was a full-time teacher of, this medieval and Renaissance literature. Would that be a fair way of summarizing some of that, or would you characterize it differently?
Well, Lewis himself said that the first of the Narnia Chronicles began with a picture. It all began with a picture of a faun in a snowy wood carrying parcels, an image, he said, that had been in his mind's eye since he was about 16 years old. And as he began to turn that picture into a story, then Aslan came bounding into it. At first, there was nothing explicitly Christian about the story, he said. But then Aslan came bounding in, and he drew it all together, and he soon drew in the other six stories after him. What Lewis doesn't say is why that picture of the faun in the snowy wood carrying parcels was so important to him, and why he thought it was worth turning into a story. He doesn't explain that. He just says that it happened, but doesn't give a reason. And I think the reason has to do with the fact that in Lewis's imagination, winter, the snowy wood, is nearly always associated with Saturn. Saturn was, as I say, the planet of coldness and death and disaster. So, as I've mentioned, he thought that his culture was too Saturnocentric, too fixated upon the winter. It needed to be overcome with images of spring and summer. And that, of course, is what happens in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, as the qualities of Jupiter, so to speak, begin to make themselves felt. Winter past and guilt forgiven. That's how he wrote about Jupiter in his Planets poem. And of course, the imagery of Jupiter is a way of presenting Lewis's Christian beliefs. He turns this symbolism to Christian effect. He described the planets as spiritual symbols of permanent value, especially worthwhile in our own generation. And the jovial qualities, the Jupiter qualities of spring and summer, forgiveness of guilt, happiness, festivity, kingliness, magnanimity, and so on and so forth, are the pervasive qualities. They are the governing tone or flavour of that first Narnia Chronicle, all put, of course, to Christian effect. And what he does with the Jupiter symbolism in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, he then does with the Mars symbolism in Prince Caspian, and with the Sun symbolism in The Dawn Treader, and so on and so forth. It's all taken and put in service of his Christian imagination.
Now, one of the things I want to point out are listeners who have listened to the other interviews. I've often pitched to the authors, what books about Lewis by other authors would you recommend? And when I do pitch that question, I would say 70 or 80% of the time, they recommend your book, either The Planet Narnia or The Narnia Code. So very highly respected. I'm sure you've gotten various comments from your readers. Do any particular reader comment stand out in terms of feedback that they very much enjoy it, they are skeptical about your approach, or what's the overall tone of the feedback that you get?
The feedback I've got for these two books has been overwhelmingly positive and supportive. It's been so encouraging. I was always hopeful, of course, that the books were going to get a good reaction because I believe that this is a genuine discovery. You know, it's not just some sort of clever idea that I've had that I'm trying to impose upon the books. I believe that it's really there. It's a genuine thing that Lewis was using and deploying. My hopes were high for the Narnia Code and the Planet Narnia book. My hopes were well exceeded. I've just been so thrilled by the depth and breadth of the positive response. People have written to me from all over the world saying that the Narnia Chronicles make so much better sense now. They've always loved the Narnia Chronicles, but there were certain mysterious things about them, and some of those mysteries now begin to make a bit better sense, like the appearance of Father Christmas in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, for instance. People have often said, what is Father Christmas doing in that book? He doesn't really seem to belong there, does he? Because the Narnians don't show any knowledge of a character called Christ. So what do they mean by Christmas? There is no Narnian Christ, so how can there be a Father Christmas character? Indeed, that was an objection that Lewis's great friend Roger Lancelin Green raised against the inclusion of Father Christmas in that first chronicle. He said, you really need to leave him out. But Lewis insisted on retaining him. And the question is why? But I think when one understands that the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe is constructed to give expression to jovial symbolism, then Father Christmas begins to make much better sense, because Lewis used to say, those born under Jupiter are red-faced. Now think of Father Christmas, loud-voiced, red-faced, jolly, the bringer of jollity. He's the nearest thing we have in our current saturnine culture to the jovial archetype, to this Jupiter personality that Lewis thought had been too nearly forgotten in our saturnine 20th and now 21st century. So Father Christmas, as it were, crystallizes that symbolic tone or flavor, and that, I think, is why Lewis included him there, even though from other points of view he doesn't very obviously belong.
Now, earlier you made reference to the BBC special and that it actually came out before the Narnia Code, but let's talk just briefly about that. The way I was going to originally ask the question was, well, first to give us some details about what that approach is, and can this video actually replace either of the books?
The BBC documentary is supplementary to the two books. It doesn't replace either of them. It's very introductory. It gives a brief overview of the case that I'm trying to make, but it assumes really no knowledge of Lewis whatsoever. And so it, in a way, that DVD is the easiest way into the whole argument. You should start really with the DVD, then go on to the Narnia Code book, and then when you want all the detail possible, then go to Planet Narnia. The DVD, the documentary, began when I happened to meet the director, Norman Stone, in New York City in 2008. I'd never met him before, but I knew of his work because it was Norman Stone who made the original BBC Shadowlands film, starring Joss Ackland and Claire Bloom as Lewis and Joy. And so I knew that Norman Stone had this interest in C.S. Lewis, and I said to him, half jokingly, do you want to make a documentary about my book? And rather to my surprise, he said, well, maybe. Write me a proposal and I'll see. So I wrote him an official proposal and he pitched that to the BBC. And again, rather surprisingly, the BBC came back and said, yeah, we'll have this. So that was how it was made. It couldn't really have been any easier. It was amazing. And then it was broadcast on our main terrestrial channel here in Britain, BBC One. At Easter in 2009, it was seen by about 2 million people, and the BBC were very pleased with that audience share, and they repeated it later on one of their digital channels, BBC Four, where it was seen by another 100,000 people. So it got good audiences and generally good reviews as well. And then, of course, the Narnia Code book came afterwards as a way of kind of following up on the success of the documentary.
Well, now, for individuals who want to maybe learn more in terms of going online, either about these books or you've written and or edited some other books, where can they go online?
The main website for Planet Narnia is simply called planetnarnia.com. There's also a website called narniacode.com. So each book has its own dedicated website. And then I've got my own personal website, michaelward.net. And I'm also on Facebook, always happy to have friends on Facebook. So those are the best ways of finding out more about the books and about me, if anybody should want that detail. Yeah.
Okay, and of course in our show notes we'll provide direct links to those sites as well. Now regarding books by Lewis, what books by him have lately meant the most to you?
Well, that's a difficult question. Lately? I don't know.
Or maybe all time. What's your all-time favorites?
Okay, yes. That's a bit easier to say. Well, my all-time favorite Lewis work of fiction is probably The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, closely followed by Till We Have Faces and That Hideous Strength. If I had to award gold, silver, and bronze medals to Lewis's fiction, that's where I'd put them, probably. Dawn Treader, Till We Have Faces, That Hideous Strength. But of course, Lewis wrote a great deal more than just fiction, and in his non-fiction, I particularly like The Second Half of Miracles, I like The Final Chapter of the Four Loves. Some of his essays are just outstanding, like The Grand Miracle, Meditation in a Tool Shed. A really important and overlooked essay is called Blusballs and Phalanspheres, and not many people know about that, partly because it's got this terribly obscure title. the essay is really about metaphor and imagination. And if Lewis had called the essay The Importance of Metaphor and Imagination, everyone would have rushed to this essay and read it repeatedly. So I'm always emphasizing the importance of this essay, his collection, Selected Literary Essays. That's also really, really good, but quite academic.
Well, I've been enjoying talking with you and would love to ask questions for hours if the time was possible, but I realize you have many other responsibilities. Before you go, any final thoughts or insights you would like to share with our listeners about Lewis?
Yeah, I think what I'd like to emphasize is that Lewis always wanted to be a poet. That was his great ambition from an early age. And he did have great poetic gifts. That is to say, he had gifts of a making ability. That's what a poet really means, a maker. He was able to imagine things and tell stories and put ideas together so beautifully and compellingly. As it happened, he tended to find that poetic gift flourished better in prose than in verse. But his verse is actually very well worth reading, and it tends to be overlooked. So I would encourage people to read his poetry more. Poetry is sometimes difficult, but often very beautiful and very skillful and deep and interesting in all sorts of ways.
Well, Michael, we appreciate your time. Thanks for the interview.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
Again, I'm William O'Flaherty, and you're listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I appreciate you being a listener of this podcast, whether it is your first time or you're a frequent listener. Be sure to follow the links in the show notes to get to Dr. Michael Ward's website or the two that support the books. Plus, I have direct links to be able to purchase those books. Also, don't forget, if you're listening to this around the time I release it, then you can soon catch a special series reflecting on each of the Narnia books. This begins on October the 16th. If it is after that date, then you can stop by the website now to download or listen to them. You can do that by going to where the show notes are, either EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the podcast files are directly hosted. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. Again, that's AllAboutJack.podbean.com. If you go to the other location, EssentialCSLewis.com, you can still get to this podcast. Plus, I have a variety of other articles there as well, including a series examining quotations alleged to be from C.S. Lewis. Additionally, at the time this show is released, I'm still doing a daily fact, quote, and quiz at EssentialCSLewis.com. I hope you enjoyed today's show enough to want to share it. Also, feel free to leave comments about the program online and consider listening to other shows. Recent ones include a special conversation I had with several Lewis scholars about the prospects of a fourth Narnia movie, and I also posted not long ago a conversation I had with Dr. Diana Glier about her book Bandersnatch that is due out in December 2015. It looks at Lewis and Tolkien and creative collaboration. Older episodes to consider listening to include a two-part show discussing The Hobbit, the movies versus the book. Again, you can hear those and others by either going to EssentialCSLewis.com or allaboutjack.podbean.com. If you have questions or comments, email them to info@EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, that's info@EssentialCSLewis.com. Finally, did you know that you can help to make sure this podcast is freely available to all? Consider becoming a financial supporter of this podcast to make sure it continues. There's a link in the show notes about this. Contributions can be as little as $1 a month. There are some great rewards possible, and no long-term commitment is necessary.